All right, so the Leafs regular season's done. It's finally here. The portion of the year that matters. I'm still trying to reconcile my feelings about this, and I think a lot of Leaf fans are in a similar spot. The season's been a tremendous success for the most part, right? Like, Brad Treliving hit on a bunch of value signings around this team. Like, yep, did he get lucky that Klingberg ended up turning into a guy that had to go on LTIR instead of someone who was going to eat up $4+ million of cap money? Yep. That was a baddie. But Bertuzzi has worked out. He's been basically what you've expected him to be in the regular season. Domi, I think, has exceeded expectations at this point. Like, guy misses two games with Matthews, and it felt materially different these last couple of games, despite even the Leafs just, you know, stat chasing. Just the energy around the team and watching Matthews and Marner, and maybe some of that is just, you know, the shared past of those two when it comes to big moments and struggling. But yeah, it really did feel like they were missing Domi. They sign McMahon, who you hope is going to be healthy. We'll talk to Mertl in a couple minutes, see what they're actually going to be able to ice when it comes to a playoff roster. He's a hit. They sign Simone Benoit, a guy who looks like he could genuinely be in their top four for the next couple of seasons at a very reasonable contract, and he shows out and becomes somebody. Austin Matthews scores 69 goals, and he's, in my opinion, at the top of the heart race, even though last night and these final couple of games actually, I think, did hurt the candidacy a little bit. Really, real. 70, the round numbers, we like it. It was an easier case. Nylander put together one of his best seasons ever, if not his best season ever. Got paid. He's part of the long-term core. Marner was quality for the most part. You look at the numbers he and Matthews had when they shared the ice together. It was still very, very, very good. You know, goals expected above average, excellent. Goals for versus against, excellent. It felt like they really did find that physical identity, that it started to bleed through the more passionate players having an impact. Certainly Matthews' goal chase, especially in the peak of it, not really so much in the chasing of it. It seemed to be there, right? Like, the Leafs were a more physical team. They were less afraid to engage in that stuff. It felt like it permeated through to a guy like Matthews at times, who I thought this season played with a different kind of energy. He's always going to have the, like, too cool look. He's always going to have that. That's a part of who he is. But I genuinely believe that there was a different jump to Matthews this season than there has been in years past. A little bit more physical, a little bit more engaged. And I do think that in part had to do with the roster that was assembled around him. I think Sheldon Keefe had a solid year. One that struggled. It had a lot of criticism, but he started to do the things that he was often criticized for, which is not being flexible enough, playing guys who deserve more ice time, and not being fixated with the loading up of lines and constant reversal back to those exact same things. Ilya Samsonov had an incredible bounce back. Like, what a story he was. A guy that we had all written off. Someone that I said was out of hockey now. Like, I really didn't think would play in the NHL again. Truly. I thought maybe, you know, he would sign like a PTO for the NHL. Like, someone bring him into camp. Maybe he would sign a vet minimum deal. But I never thought that he was going to play for the Leafs again. Certainly not. Certainly not. I thought the bigger question was, would he be in the NHL again? He comes back. He rebounds. And he rips off a ton of wins and looks great and gets the support of the fan base. It was enjoyable. It was really enjoyable to watch. Their goaltender, Joseph Woll, the other one, he had a really quality season for what I still think is, you know, like a rookie. Not a true rookie, but a rookie. He gets injured, and that'll remain the question for him next season is, can you stay healthy? But there was a moment there where you really saw it. You really saw what the upside of this kid was. And I think that it's going to be a real building block season for him in terms of confidence. Their blue line kind of remained a mismatch. It was probably their biggest trouble spot from start to finish. Just they never could quite figure it out. But good seasons from McCabe. It was really, like, if you want to talk about, you know, solid contributors to this team, he was absolutely one of them. Fearless player, guy who loves to lay a big hit. You know, gets himself out of position at times. I think chases the game a little bit at times, loses his mind at times. Sam and I always joke about how he's the all wires crossed guy. But a really good player, and especially on that cap figure. And then, yeah, I mentioned the emergence of Benoit. Tougher year for Morgan Rielly. And again, coming back from injury and the, he has the cross check. And from that point forward, just like really never settled back into the season. The Leafs had a ton of success without him. Then it felt like he was pressing, and down the stretch, he was probably one of the bigger culprits in terms of not great play. And yeah, TJ Brody, obviously, like, he became the team's whipping boy. And yesterday it was hilarious because he scores a goal, and it's like, it's the only time you could score a goal, and people go, are you serious, man? Are you serious? You really doing this? So yeah, it's all done. The regular season's done. We went through a billion narratives, as we always do. And guess what? We're back here. We're back here where it matters. It's the Stanley Cup playoffs. And yet I do feel as though there is a, and I'll admit, some of this is me, and I don't think that this is everyone. I just think that for some people, there's a little bit of apathy this year. Like, you thought you were facing the Panthers. You were scared of that matchup. You know, now you're facing a Boston Bruins team that is not what they were last season. Like, don't get it twisted. That Bruins team that went in the postseason was clicking on all cylinders and was supposed to be the most dangerous team in hockey. I know that they own the Leafs, but you go through just about everything. Their offense last year, it was number two in the NHL. This year is 14th. Their expected goals for 5-on-5. They're sitting around the middle of the pack. They're 15th in the NHL. Their power play dipped a little bit. Their defensive numbers dipped. They were like, you know, they're 19th in 5-on-5 goals expected against this season. It's like, it's a pretty, frankly, they're quite a mediocre hockey team. Like, I know that some of you just recoiled at this, at that noise that I just made from my mouth. Because you go, oh my God, please don't say things like that, because they're going to put that in their dressing room. And that, I don't think they need any more motivation. I don't think that they need any other psychological edges, because that's the main thing in this series is, even though it's only Brad Marchand that goes back all the way to the beginning of the trauma against the Boston Bruins, there is always that big brother feeling, and something that the Leafs have proven, I think, kind of conclusively in the postseason so far, is that you put the body to them and they wilt a bit. They're not the same team when it gets tight and it gets physical and the games get hard. That certainly hasn't been the case for Mitch Marner, who had his droughts. It wasn't the case for Austin Matthews, I'm sorry, who played better against the Tampa Bay Lightning last season, who got his opportunities at times against Montreal and Florida and some of the more difficult defeats, but ultimately didn't translate those things into goals. William Nylander has been that guy, but, you know, you, as much as you really do feel confident that he had, as Sheldon Keefe said, finished with the regular season, it was still a guy in search of 100 points was a meaningful milestone for him, and he fell short. And, you know, the guy was, what, 11 games in a row, no goals? He was a dash three in that time, and he only had four apples? It's not the best way to go into the postseason. And so I think that people look at this Boston matchup and say, like, if you're me, if you're feeling the way that I do, it's like, yeah, the matchup is good. The matchup is solid in comparison to every other year that you face the Bruins or every other iteration that the Bruins have essentially had in the last decade. The Leafs are good. They've got a lot of positive signs moving forward. But prove it. Go out and prove it against the Boston Bruins, as always. And then I think you'll start to get people engaged. Anyways, I'm going to do stake rankings with James Myrtle. I got a ton of questions for him in terms of how this series is going to go. And God, what ended up happening down the stretch there? Because I'm still trying to reconcile what that actually has, if that has any meaning to the Toronto Maple Leafs. James Myrtle, Senior Managing Editor of The Athletic. Good morning, sir. How are we?
I'm good. That was quite a soliloquy there to start us off.
Yeah, sorry, I went a little long. It's just, yeah, it's a long season, right?
So you're going to do every player on the roster. I was like,
no,
okay.
But it was more so, it's like, yeah. Listen, first of all, trying to get you ready in the green room, right? I ran the light. I'm sorry. But it's true. It's like we get through this entire regular season. There's all these stories and there's all these things. And you try to take the pieces from the regular season that you think matter going into the postseason, right? And so I guess let's start with that. What do you think that we saw this year that is going to materialize or matter the most when it comes to the postseason?
I think this is a hard one to predict, but I think that the one thing you can point to with this team potentially over last year is they came into the year wanting to build a more playoff battle ready lineup. That was the point of everything. And I guess the other point was maybe a little bit more secondary scoring.
Yep.
You know, the book on this team was they're not going to be as good defensively. It definitely played out that way this year. They should be better offensively. I think they were maybe a little bit better offensively than last year. Certainly over the second half, you know, they were number one, number two in goals per game for the last 3-4 months of the season. So I would say that played out. And then you can see, you know, the toughness throughout the lineup. And you know, in fairness, they tried to bring that in last year at the deadline. Like they brought in McCabe and O'Reilly and Shen and like there were Achari. There were pieces that came in that brought that element. But this year they tried to have it throughout the season. They tried to have it higher in the lineup in some cases, Bertuzzi, Domi. And they need to hope that that identity shift is what makes a difference, I think. Because if you look on paper, I'm not so sure. Like, this team didn't come in and blow last year. They finished, 9 points behind where they were last year, lower in the standings. Goals against was way up. Special teams don't look as good. But you're hoping that the intangibles, the physical play, the being able to step up when the games get tight, you're hoping that that's the difference between this team and last year.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on both accounts. Those are the things that I do feel like I learned. This team is more willing to engage in the physical stuff. I do think that they're a tougher team. I don't think that they are going to wilt in the same ways that they have in the past. And I think that some of that has been a little overstated. But, you know, ultimately, the best players are going to set the tenor for that. But, no, the up and down the lineup, there's more size. They're a bigger, stronger team than they have been in iterations past. And I do think that there is something to, you know, it being there at the very beginning and not a deadline transplant, even though last year's deadline transplant, I think, really worked. And that was a very, very good team. I'm totally with you on that. The bigger thing to me, though, is what you mentioned after, which is the secondary scoring. Is the part that matters most to me that we saw is I believe that a guy like Domi, a guy like Bertuzzi, a guy like McMahon, a guy like Yarncroc, like you go down the lineup, Nyes, whatever, there are just more players that can have a meaningful impact in the series offensively, put one by the Boston Bruins, and take some of that pressure off the Stars than any year prior. Like this is the first time where I haven't felt like, man, if it's not Matthews, Marner, Tavares, and Nylander, they're dead. You know, they're never going to have a game. I could absolutely see a game where those guys, you know, the core four end up with a couple assists and then the Leafs win 3-2 on the backs of a bunch of those other guys who scored the three goals in this hockey game, right? And I'm curious to see how that impacts this hockey team mentally when Matthews, Marner, Tavares, and Nylander don't feel as though they need to just be carrying the entire scoring load where it has to be like, you know, 80% of the playoff scoring.
Well, I think that's what's bumped them up over the last, what would you say, 2.5 or 3 months,
yeah,
from being a good offensive team to being one of the best 2 or 3 offensive teams in the NHL. Like, it's not like the power play's on fire right now. Oof. The Stars were already scoring a ton in the first half. Like, Matthews and Nylander were on that crazy pace. You know, it was really the depth players start putting the puck in the net. You know, like, look at how many games there were over the last 30-35 where it was you got a goal from a Holmberg or a McMahon or someone down the lineup did something and Domi and Bertuzzi came alive and were more kind of what we thought they would be coming into the season. And yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, it sounds weird to say that has to be such a factor given the star power they have at the top of the lineup, but how many times have we seen those players getting really stymied and really shut down and there's just nothing else down the lineup? Like, think of all the postseasons where it was Kerfoot and Engvall and Mikheyev and, you know, who am I forgetting? Like, you know, the players who just really couldn't make an impact offensively at all, who were on the third and fourth line, and those lines were just going out there and you were just waiting for them to get off so that something might happen in the game.
Yeah, I would call them the punt lines. It felt like punt line, punt line, punt line. And I really do feel as though that exacerbated the struggles for the Leafs, like the gripping the sticks too tight, right? Like, this is what I think is bothering people, and or at least what bothered me. I should stop saying people. I'll just say me. This is what made me a little traumatized over this Matthews stretch, is it felt like, Matthews, it's got to be Matthews. And what did that remind me of? Playoffs, right? Where it's like, we need Matthews, and then it doesn't end up happening, and you go, that is the exact same feeling that you had in the postseasons past. This is exactly how it felt against Montreal. This is exactly how it felt against Columbus in the fake playoff series. This is exactly how it felt last year at times against Florida, where if you weren't getting a goal from Austin Matthews, you weren't getting it from anywhere else in the lineup, and then all of a sudden the game ends and he's got a ton of shots and he has a bunch of opportunities and a lot of, oh, it was so close, but not quite. And you end up losing the hockey game. And this year now that they're going to move out of that, right, this last final four games, and this is why, you know, maybe I'll get into the psychology of that in a second in terms of where you think it has an impact on the team. That is the part that I think is going to matter for them, is if they can come out here against Boston in game one or game two, right, split this series, but have it be during a game where a couple of the secondary guys score one and then the other guys start to flow. That's when I'm going to say, look out for the Toronto Maple Leafs. They might be doing something this year.
Yeah, and I think you made a good point off the top. The Bruins aren't this juggernaut President's Trophy winning team. They were 7 points ahead of them in the standings this year. They're not as deep down the lineup. They're definitely not that deep at center. Mm-mm. I look at their blue line. I read McAvoy's obviously a star. Lindholm's been really good since they brought him in. But after that, you can do some damage against that Boston blue line. I mean, I'm sure we're going to get into this more, but there's one very obvious difference between these teams, and I don't think it's not in offensive firepower, and it's not in on the blue line. You know, the biggest difference is the two goaltenders that Boston has. But other than that, this is going to be a very, very even series, and there's going to be an opportunity for depth players to take advantage of, you know, some of the players that Boston rolls out down the lineup. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to ask you, that was actually my follow-up, was like, where do you think that the biggest discrepancy is? And I think it's either the Leafs' top two centermen versus what Boston can ice, or like the Leafs' forward group in general versus what Boston can ice, or the goaltending. But it sounds like you think the goaltending is the greatest discrepancy between these two teams.
Yeah, last night I was just looking through comparing the teams in all these different ways, and Boston, they're getting so much from having two goalies that played as well. Like it's like having two top 10 goalies in the league, you know. And I know they had a hard time translating that in the playoffs last year, and that was part of what got them. It sounds like they're going to go full rotation in the playoffs, which is going to be they did it almost all year. Like they went back and forth all year, other than I think there was like three games or something where they didn't do that. So it'd be pretty interesting to see a different guy every second game if that's the way that they go. I do think that's the difference, because I don't see a big difference anywhere else.
Yeah, I do with the forward groups. I think that Toronto's forwards better, you know, have a much, much, much bigger impact in the series. Like you look down Boston.
Boston's always like bigger than the sum of their parts, though, the way that they play. Like, you know, you look on paper and it's like, oh, they look thin at center, but then you play against them and it's like, it doesn't, you know, they're just they're super well coached. They're really good defensively. They're in the right spots. You know, Bergeron was obviously a beast, but they're a really smart team.
They are. I think that's another tip in the Boston side of the ledger, is that they're a much more well coached team. Like they do not have as many breakdowns as the Toronto Maple Leafs have. Not throughout the course of this regular season. Like, that is the thing. You're right. They are better than the sum of their parts. But when push comes to shove and this series ends up happening, that has to be the key for Toronto. I'm sorry. Like, it can't be anything else. They can't be hoping Samsonov outplays one of these guys and that they can goalie the Boston Bruins. Like, they've got to play with force and go, okay, sorry, what's your third line? Frederick, Geeky, Van Riemsdyk? Yeah, we're caving that in. You know, like...
Not only that, but like other than Pastrnak, who really scares you, like you watch Brad Marchand this year and he's finally slowing down and looking older. And like there's a big separation there between Pastrnak and everybody else. And then you look at the Leafs and it's like, well, you know, the Leafs have like three guys who can really should be able to dominate a game. So, yeah, you're right. That does have to be a big separation.
It absolutely has to be. Like, what's the gap? I think Pastrnak has 110 points and Marchand has 67.
Yeah, it's
like everyone made this huge deal about Kucherov this season in terms of his, you know, heart candidacy. Like, his team stinks, and so he's good, and that's why he should win, which is crazy. Like, the people who are voting for Kucherov are driving me insane. Like, I can barely get words out because it's so, don't do that. He's so clearly fourth out of this entire group of guys, but whatever.
Lots of voters look at the point standings and like, he's going to get lots of like easy votes with that. Like, and a lot of people will have him second too, as a result of that.
And so
it's going to be close.
I know. I think he has my understanding of it from shopping around and texting people is that he has it's going to be MacKinnon, but if it isn't MacKinnon, it's going to be Kucherov. And that's not what the betting odds reflected the last time I saw it. But yeah, that's lunatic behavior. Like every day. I love how, hold on, I'm just going one quick side tangent here. I love how the analytics community and every article I ever read on your site and every site now is like 5-on-5 numbers, 5-on-5 numbers. Like, that's all we ever look at, right? That's all we ever want to discuss. And then all of a sudden it comes down to this and people are like, well, secondary assists on the power play for Kucherov, you got to give it to him. And I'm like, okay, I guess so. We're getting smarter.
That's not analytics people saying that, though.
Okay, sure. What? Oh, I mean, you guys, who's going to be getting votes? I've looked through the who gets votes. It's a lot of people from your side. It's a lot of people from here. I'm just saying that it's like.
Well, we put out our trophy. We had MacKinnon narrowly ahead of Matthews. It was 1-2, and then Kucherov got dinged big time for the defensive play stuff.
Yeah, no kidding.
Our breakdown. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. It's like we get all smarter as hockey fans. We're all supposed to be way smarter. We're all supposed to be like getting all this added information. We can watch in a different way than we ever could before, right? Like there's access to every single game all of the time, and we have all these numbers and all these that, and they're not perfect, but it's better than ever. And here we are going into the Hart Trophy candidacy and being like, man, Kucherov, do you see all his secondary power play assists? You got to give it to
him. This might shock you, but the voters for the Hart Trophy are the hockey writers, and they're not all analytics.
No. But I don't even think it's just like it's driving me nuts. Anyways, back to the thing. Do you believe in the psychology of the not getting 70 for Matthews impacting this team in a negative way? Because there is a part of me going, man, it was another thing that you guys set out to accomplish and you didn't. And yeah, like they were unstructured, and Keefe had that quote about how these four games, he doesn't even know the scores. It was clear what they were doing. They were stat chasing. They were going for the 70, but ultimately they didn't accomplish the goal over their final four games of the season, which I don't know. I think it's fair to extrapolate at least a tiny bit of that into the energy that you're taking into, or the momentum that you're taking into a series. No,
I don't know. Maybe a little tiny bit. I wonder the momentum of just not really playing a real game and not playing anything that matters and losing those four games, and just they haven't looked good. Right. So I just wonder if some of that carries over. What's the last game you feel really good about how they played and they look like how you want them to in the playoffs? And because that's been a problem in the past coming into the playoffs, is the Leafs come in still playing like they have in the regular season. You know, I remember 2018, 2019, those early games against Boston, and the Leafs just looking like they were still kind of getting over that part of that end of the regular season that didn't mean anything, whereas Boston was ready to go right away. So I think I would worry about that a little bit more than, I think Matthews is going to be ready to go. So is the rest of the team going to have a 69 goal hangover? I don't know, but I would worry a little bit that they haven't had to play for anything in quite a while, and they got to snap into the mindset of playing their best hockey right away on Saturday.
I'd buy that more if the team was a younger team, you know? I'd buy that more if they had been chasing this when Matthews and Marner were 22, 23. Boston did the same thing. Boston didn't play their last couple of games of the season. And so, we're going to parse over when the last time, the last time the Leafs played good games was on the 8th
Boston's
and 9th.
Boston's always ready, though. Boston's always ready for the playoffs, and Toronto isn't.
Totally.
Yeah. Although, I mean, the Bruins weren't exactly ready last year. But
that's what I'm saying, is if we're looking at this just from a non, hey, this is the Toronto Maple Leafs, everything goes, they played two really quality games against Pittsburgh and against the Devils and back-to-back on the 8th and 9th. It's the 18th today. It's been 10 days since they played good hockey. It's going to end up being what's the math? Three more days, two more nights. Yeah. Two more nights. So, I don't think that's the biggest deal to me anyways. Maybe that's wrong. And I'm not saying I'm right, you're wrong. That to me has been more secondary, because I've just seen enough times where these guys have snapped into shape, have snapped into form. And I think that is a part of who they are as a group, and they understand the stake. To me, the thing just remains that they clearly grip their sticks too tight in big moments, they do. And to me, if you view this as a big moment, scoring 70 goals, which I do, because they decided to punt the last four games of the season on this, and certainly the last two, it's they look like a team that was tight. They look like a team that was chasing it in times. And yeah, I didn't really love that Keefe is consoling Austin Matthews, and that the guys on the team who scored goals are looking at Matthews sheepishly, even though Tavares's was criminal. I think he should be at least put in prison for 24 hours for the way that he acted on that power play with Matthews. But yeah, that part of it is man, when the moments get tight and the moments get tough, would have been nice to see it come through. That's all.
Yeah, when Matthews had 20 shot attempts and ringing it off the bar. And it was mostly bad luck, right?
Guess what? Hey, where have you heard that before? Every postseason. Hey, Montreal, I got a chance. Mostly bad luck. Hey, that's what every Leaf fan that has supported the core four has said every single playoff exit.
No
is.
Way. Montreal, game six and game seven, it's just complete no show.
I know, but I'm just saying that it was
not bad luck if you you know, only have five shots on goal in a game that matter. Yeah. Like,
yeah, they broke by that point. I'm just saying that every year it's always, oh, well, you know, Bobrovsky even last season, look at how many shots they got. You could argue they outplayed them and they got goalied and they got their chances. It's bad luck.
There has been a lot of that.
Bad luck. It's a lot of bad luck. Oh, this game is stupid. It mostly comes down to bad luck. I'm like, okay. Like, all right, whatever you say so. It's a lot of bad luck. It's conspiring.
Yeah, once you get to the eighth time.
Yeah,
then...
that's what I mean. And this is another example of where it's like, oh, it's just bad luck. Okay, fine. I guess it was all bad luck. I'm trying. I'm doing my best here. Okay, so getting to the postseason. Matthews, yeah, you got to hope he's fine. Because, again, he's got to still got to drive the bus, still needs to score a bunch of goals. And I do think that the legacy of the season for me, like, you know, I have my legacy rankings in terms of, like, who this means the most to. I actually have Matthews still third. But, yeah, if he goes into this postseason, they get knocked out in six games. And he only scores a goal or two. I think that is going to put a pretty significant damper on the way that we remember the 69 goals and the way that the rest of the league does. Because it's like, this is Toronto, not Washington. Like, no one remembers Ovi's 65 goal season in terms of like what happened after, but people here will, you know? So that it's a big one for him. He's definitely got to do it. But for you, who has the most at stake personally? One person who has the most at stake going into this postseason? You can pick front office to, you know, depth defenseman.
Well, I mean, Sheldon Keefe is like they have to do something.
That's
like,
why I have this one as well.
I can't. He's fighting for his job here. Mm-hmm. Like this series is it. So, because there's going to be changes if they go out in five or six. I mean, I think if they lose in the first round, there's going to be changes. So, and it feels like he would be the number one. You know, and then it would be back to the discussion about the core and. You got both Tavares and Marner with 1 year left on their deal. Mm-hmm. You know, the DNA of your team and your cap picture and everything, you know. So I would go number one, Keith, for sure, because everything's on the line for him. And then it's probably Marner and Matthews are right there next.
That's what I have. I have it as Keith 1, Marner 2, Matthews 3, Nylander 4, Samsonov 5. My biggest question, though, to you is, did I improperly do this because Brendan Shanahan's name should be on that list higher?
Yeah, and, you know, he's another one. He's got 1 year left in his deal. Mm-hmm. He's got a new boss coming in. There's some things moving around with the ownership structure. Michael Grange had a great story about that a couple weeks ago, if people didn't see it, just about everything that's going on. You know, so you got a new boss, and I know for a fact ownership is very frustrated with how bad the Leafs have been in the playoffs. And, I mean, if you're you got two media companies, you know, that rely on ratings and interest, and part of the calculation, I think, when they bought the national TV package was, hey, the Leafs are going to be in the playoffs and they're going to, you know, those are the games everyone's watching. Like, can you imagine the viewership of the Leafs going on a run to the, you know, third and fourth round? And like, it would just be unbelievable.
James, you know, imagine it because I imagine it every year. That's the most hilarious thing about doing this job is like tying the thing that I wish I could, if there's one thing I could do to go back to younger me, you know, who was getting into this industry, I would say, hey, you know how that team that has like shattered your hopes and dreams, your entire existence? And I would go, uh-huh, yeah. It's like, you want to talk about them, right? Because it's fun. And you'd be like, oh, definitely. Like, that's a dream of mine. And they go, well, how would you feel about being tied financially to their successes? And I would be like, oh, well, that wouldn't be very wise. I'd be like, yeah, exactly. Now, maybe go to law school. that's maybe just, you know, follow through on your plan. And you're not too big to go to the University of Manitoba. You just go. Just go. Just, you know, do it. Anyways, I agree with you. I just wonder if he would get the opportunity, if it's a first round exit, to be the guy that has to make those heavy decisions.
I suspect there'll be a one more year kind of situation there, but I think everything's going to be I think that ownership group, there's a lot of people there who feel the way the fans do, who are just kind of fed up with this and they want to see something substantial shift. Yep. They just can't, they're tired of Groundhog Day. So the Leafs need to show that they're not the same team, mm-hmm. you know, but it's a huge series. I'm glad it's Boston. This makes sense. Like, this is like, you know, they've been through, they've played them three times, and it just means more than if you beat Florida. It will.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what I really like about it too, now that we're talking it through, is Boston is not as good. like, it's conclusive from a full regular season of who they are and just, you know, some of the names on the back of the jerseys at this point, right? Like, you've gone from Patrice. It's one thing if Patrice Bergeron shuts you down. You get shut down by Pavel Zacha. It's not going to be as easy to swallow. And I think if you're a Leaf fan, the one thing that you can kind of take solace in, or even if you're this front office and trying to make these decisions, is like, they've been paralyzed by breaking up the core four, right? It's, oh my God, the idea that you trade Mitch Marner for pieces and it's not the sum of the whole, and he goes on to be great in Anaheim or what, you know, like, who? And this the history of this market in terms of chasing players and guys not want to be, it's too hard, blah, blah, blah. They go and have successes other places. You can't make a good Marner trade. You can't make a good Marner trade. Oh, you got to just keep doubling down and doing the same thing over and over again. You lose to this Boston team, and it looks like part of it is just the inability of the core four to push through, play these tough games, overcome the challenges that are going to be in front of them mentally. Then, you know, it's like, you, these guys weren't juggernauts. You were just as good as them. They outplayed you. They had the intangibles. And, you know, you actually do have to work on the intangibles at this point. It isn't just a skill league.
Yeah, and I think Boston's a great example of an intangibles team. Like, they're, you know, they play like a great team and a great system. And you can see it when they have injuries. Like, you take McAvoy out for 2 weeks, and it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, they plug in different guys. And, you know, like, who would have everyone, all the dire predictions when Bergeron retired, you know, Pavel Zacha is going to be your first line center, and the Bruins are going to drop 20 points in the standings, and, you know, not, you know, it didn't really happen, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's a testament to coaching staff. It's a testament to, it's a smart team. They have a lot of smart players over there. And I think one of the challenges for the Leafs is they're not really a smart team. Like, you know, they make a lot of mistakes, and, you know, the goaltending's been kind of all over the place. So they just got to hope that they're not making mistakes that are going to kill them against a team that's going to be waiting to capitalize on those mistakes.
Mm-hmm. So the guy that I have number four in the rankings in terms of stakes is William Nylander. His are lower because he just got paid. He's not going anywhere because he put in a no move. But yeah, he had 11 games with no goals and 4 assists and -3. And Sheldon Keefe said yesterday that he wasn't, what was the quote, Mike? He said something like, he seems pretty clear he was done playing regular season hockey. I think that they put it in my doc. I don't want to misquote it because that gets everybody all riled up and pissed off, and nobody likes that stuff. But yeah, he basically insinuated that, he's over it. He's just, there it is. I think in the last week, Willie's sort of shown that he's done with regular season hockey. He's ready to move along, but I'm not concerned about Willie, end quote. Okay, so I think a lot of us are giving him the benefit of the doubt because he has shown up in the playoffs. There's a two-part question. One is, are you keeping him on a line by himself? And like, yes, it's better talent, but as the guy who's supposed to drive the line definitively, a third-line player, or are you putting him back with, you know, more, you know, dominant players regularly? Like, you're not screwing around with that. You put him in with Marner and Tavares and saying, nope, this is a loaded line. And yeah, if he, you know, does fall apart here, the reason why I think that the stakes are big for him is he goes back to being one of the most polarizing players in Leafs history, because everyone's going to have the exact same narrative of, you got paid and you changed. And then his defenders are going to remain, steadfast, because they always do.
I got to be honest, I'm a little bit worried about him. And I'm a bit worried about him down on that third line, because it's been such a tough, 11 games, 15 mm-hmm. games. I think he's got one goal and 5 points and 15 or something to end the year. Like, he hasn't been anything close to what he was the rest of the season. And it wasn't just like a 3 or a 4 game thing. It was mm-hmm. basically a whole month. So, mm-hmm. and you read the quotes coming from Nylander. I know we had a story on him a couple of days ago, and it's like, oh boy, this seems like a guy who's kind of in his own head a little bit. And he really wanted the 100 points. It looked like it was going to be a given for most of the year, and then he didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that, you know, you're playing with Holmberg. You're not getting the opportunities that maybe you did earlier in the year, and you've got this drought. I could see it start to snowball on him a little bit. I think I would start the playoffs that way, but if you need a goal, you got to move him up the lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And Keefe's done a pretty good job of, in this configuration, making sure Nylander still gets his 19, 20 minutes a game mm-hmm. by mixing and matching the lines. So I think you start this way, you win game one and it looks good, then you stick with it. But they're not going to be able to win this series if Nylander's the Nylander he's been for the last, you know, month of the season.
I actually have him as my most important X factor. Like, it's weird to call him an X factor, but it's the way I look at it is if he can dominate those third line minutes, that looks to me like one of the biggest advantages that Toronto has. And yes, he will 100%, Keefe is 100% going to mishmash these things. I watched Elliot on the panel the other day and he was asked a question and he basically answered it with, it doesn't matter because all these guys are going to play together and they're going to have a bunch of different looks. And you go, yep, I actually agree with that. But no more so than Nylander playing third line minutes to start, but them constantly and consistently putting him with Tavares and Marner on a second line and trying to get more offense from him. The thing that worries me, though, is like, yeah, that is the only times that you really did see him. And the other part of it is, and I don't think anybody said this, because I read that piece too. I think it was Jonas's piece, right, where he interviewed Nylander 101. It was a good piece. Nylander's, the entire premise of him is that he is unbothered by the market and he is unbothered by pressure and he is Mr. Cool. And then here he is in an article going, and I'm not criticizing him for being honest, it's fine, or whatever the way you want to spin it, but here he is in an article going, yeah, I think that, you know, the chase for 100 and the contract, that these are weighing on me mentally. And I went, oh yeah, now I'm reminded that Mitch Marner the year after his contract was the worst version of himself, right? That this tends to have an effect on players is you get that contract and it has, an impact on what you're doing mentally. And for a guy like Nylander, who was having his career season, who was doing all these amazing things, now he's stepping into a playoff series with the guy I view as his big brother, David Pastrnak. And it's like, what's Pasta going to do in this series? You know what my guess is? A lot. You know what a safe prediction is that the Leaf Killer is going to kill the Leafs on a few occasions. Can he look like a semblance of the player that he got paid more money than? And I think it's going to be very important for him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Nylander came into this season with a huge chip on his shoulder and there was all the talk about the contract and what is he worth? And then he was tied for third in NHL scoring, 3 months into the year. And the Leafs had felt like they had to pay him, So it's, and to your point, you're right. Like Nylander normally is the guy where the market and the pressure doesn't bother him. That's why when I saw some of the quotes, and you see the way he's playing, it's like, what's going on here? Like, this is not like him. Mm-hmm. So the question is there going to be a switch that's flipped and he's ready to go for game one? Or is some of this going to hang around him? Because they need him to be good. Mm-hmm. Tavares was a 65-point player this year. I guess you don't know what you're going to get from Matthews and Marner in the playoffs, but you at least know that those are your weapons. But if you can have a third one in Nylander, Boston can't match that, especially if they're on different lines.
I actually have no idea what I'm going to get from Marner in the playoffs. Like, what's your Marner opinion since he came back from the injury? Like, to me, he's played largely purposeless hockey.
Yeah, he's had a weird season.
Uh-huh.
He's had a really slow start and then really, really good for a stretch. I don't know. He's been kind of all over the place, right? So He's played better with Matthews, he's just much more noticeable there, but spreading the wealth makes more sense to me, especially against a team like Boston.
Ugh. I don't feel better about this now.
It's going to be close, mate. It's going to be a 7-game series.
Yeah.
It's going to come down to, can the Leafs hold on to some leads?
Game 7 in TD Garden, great. Like, it's great.
I've been to I've been there 2013, 18, 19. You walk into that building for a game 7 and it's like, I'm intimidated. I'm just here to write a story on my laptop. And it's it's an atmosphere. It's I've been to cup finals and I've been to the Olympics and those games are amazing, amazing atmosphere.
This is honestly
credit to the fan base, but it intimidates the players for sure.
Yeah. I refuse to have anybody ever say anything otherwise. No, a lot of what I love about this job is that you get to talk things out, you get to talk things through. And where I'm landing on this is I started the segment basically trying to figure out why some of the fans are a little apathetic this year and why some of the fans, it just doesn't feel as exciting despite Matthews, and why I think the 70 was important is the fan base being like, yes, this happened. Like, what an awesome thing. Like, roll it in the playoffs. They're cruising. They got the different guys. And then Domi got hurt. And then, the rest of the lineup had some injuries to it. And Matthews sits on 69 and Nylander doesn't crack 100 points. And it's like, you didn't carry the swagger through that you really wanted to. And I think that's happened with the fans as well. And when we're painting these pictures about the postseason, it's way too familiar for people. And everyone's like, maybe just give me a round. You know, give me a round to get excited for. Like, it used to be, all right, now it's time for the stakes because the first round was the everything. And now it's kind of like, damn, they might really go back to losing in the first round, and it could end up being very familiar, like overly familiar, and you got to be guarded against that. The same way, like, Blue Jays fans are guarded coming into the season, seeing this offense and seeing their manager make the decisions that he makes, and the offense just sputter at times and fail to cash runners in scoring position, is the same that I think a lot of Leaf fans are feeling going into this postseason. We're like, you just can't separate the years prior. You can't separate the teams prior.
No, I mean, there's a huge portion of the fan base that doesn't believe in this team. Yeah. So, and I don't blame them.
Yeah.
I mean, they've seen them, you know, they've seen them fail so many times. They're going to have to win them over the course of these games and these series, you know, and I think they're going to have to, I think to really change hearts and minds, you got to be, you know, beat Boston and then play better in the second round than they did last year.
Mm-hmm. Hearts and minds. Yeah. You'll see. Okay. Last one. What's your blue line configuration to start game one?
I don't know.
I know this is the great, like the poor, but just do your best, do your best.
I think Lyubushkin's playing the worst out of the top seven that they've got. Okay. I would think about sitting Lyubushkin.
Mm-hmm.
I like Benoit McCabe. I want Edmondson playing. I would play Brody.
So you're playing Brody with Nylander with Riley then.
That'd be interesting.
No. Yeah, you're playing him with Riley then. Sorry, I have the two guys written in my notes of like the two coldest guys, Riley and Nylander, and so I just flipped them because to me they're like the same guy.
I mean,
right?
you don't have to play Brody with Riley.
You play Riley with Liljegren against the Bruins.
Yeah.
The Boston Bruins.
Maybe you do have to go with Lyubushkin in and just hope that he's not throwing grenades to the other team. Like, maybe, I don't know. Yeah, so I guess what they probably do, and I understand why they would do it, would be Riley, Lyubushkin, Benoit McCabe, mm-hmm. and you get your veteran guys on the third pair in Brody and Edmondson. Feels weird not to have Liljegren in there, but he's missed a lot of time. So
I have Liljegren in there. I have it as this. Benoit McCabe, Lyubushkin, Riley, Edmondson, Liljegren. And I'm leaving Brody out for this reason. I get it. If you're Sheldon Keefe, you're going, man, you know, he's a vet and he's important in the room and everybody loves him. And, you know, he's been steady. He's been a soldier. Some of the stuff probably is a little overstated. But you know who I feel the most nervous about when it comes to trying to get pucks out of their own end? Like, who I'm most nervous about when it comes to the other team's forecheck? It's the guy that plays on his offhand and has bobbled more pucks than anybody this season. Like, it's that part of the game. If you're afraid of the Bruins' ability to score, it's that they're going to do the same thing. Hard forecheck, turnovers, create opportunities and use their physicality and size. Who do you get images of when you're like, oh, he's going in the corner, he's got to play a puck. Oh, there he is on his offside, and oh, he turned it over. Now the puck's out in the slot, bang, in the back of the net over Samsonov's shoulder. It's Brody.
I mean, that could be three or four guys.
Yes,
on the
I agree.
Right now.
I totally agree. They're a grenade launching team, like the one Lyubushkin had against the Pittsburgh Penguins comes to mind, right?
Oh,
where you're like, holy crap, dude, what does he see? But also, or like Giordano, what game was that where he's turning around the net and he just whips one right in the middle of the ice, like literally tape to tape into the slot? No, they've got guys who turn the puck over, but you know what I'm saying? When it comes to the physical play in the corners, the guy who seems to have the toughest time is Ben Brody to me. And so I think he's game one scratch. Like, that's the best I think you can start with. And then if any of those guys has a bad game, essentially, because nobody's safe outside of, to me, Benoit, McCabe, Riley, Edmondson, then basically Lyubushkin or Liljegren, one of you two has a bad game, cool, you're out, Brody's in.
Yeah, I think that I go Brody over Liljegren, I think, just because I think down the lineup, and maybe you play Brody on the left side, and it's really tough, though. I think probably like the forwards with the defense, we're going to see a bunch of different pairings mashed together, and it's going to be fluid, and it's going to be changing. And it's funny that the one thing that everyone agrees on is Benoit McCabe, which, I mean, good for Benoit. I mean, what a year that he's had. You know, who would have thought that would be the one pairing you could count on all season? But I don't know who you put against Pastrnak and you feel good about on this team.
You don't know?
Well, I mean, those two, I guess.
No, I know. No one. Duh. Like, what are you talking about? There's no answer to that of, oh, that's what you feel good. It's like the nightmare every single time he's on the ice, obviously.
See, it shouldn't be like that for the other team. The Bruins fans should be feeling like that in a playoff series with any of Matthews or Nylander or Marner out there. That's what they need to make happen.
Yeah. This is why it's incredibly important for Matthews to establish this. Like, this is my other part of it is, you know, you're in the conversation with all these guys in the heart, right? But every one of them that is in this conversation has won, right? Kucherov's won. McKinnon has won. Crosby has won. You're there with these winners. And McDavid is a separate entity, which is, if you don't think McDavid is conclusively and by a significant margin the best player in the NHL, like, I think you're trying too hard. You know, you're pressing here. It's very clear who's the best guy in hockey. If they were just doing the best player award, it would be him every single year, and we wouldn't even need to... This, like, he'd have to play like NBA style 65 games to qualify for this thing. If Matthews really wants to be in that company, he's got to start feeling that way in the postseason. You know, he doesn't need to win the Stanley Cup this year, but he's got to feel that way in the playoffs where the other team is just living in fear of him and he's just coming out and scoring big goals. And that's the big legacy shifter for him, in my opinion.
He should be deciding games.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it's like 69 goals. I mean, yeah. Seven game playoff series. You should have six goals.
Yeah.
Like that's like the bar that you've set. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's enough for today. I'll be talking to you all playoffs, obviously. James, thanks for making time, buddy.
Yeah. Thanks, JD.
See you, pal. James Myrtle, senior managing editor at The Athletic. Oof. Nervous. You know what though? I do love it. I will say that. As awful as it is to talk about and talk through at times, you get there and you go, God, this is so great. Just the anticipation, the butterflies, the playoff hockey, nothing beats it. Well, playoff baseball gets close. I love the feeling of playoff baseball. Because with basketball, it doesn't, like, until it gets later, it doesn't feel that way, you know? Like, you gotta, like, Raptors being in the Eastern Conference Finals, Raptors, tragically, LeBron stuff, that was, those feelings, like, when it's Bismack Biyombo, and he's
pinning LeBron.
Yeah, exactly. That's where you feel like, oh, basketball has so much juice, is when those games get high stakes. But the first round now, like, I could barely even watch the play-in games yesterday, and one of them was a 1-point win. I'm like tuning into it for a second. I'm like, oh, no thanks. What's the stakes here? None. This feels like the in-season tournament still. Let me see it when it's the Eastern Conference and Western Conference finals, you know? Let me see it when it's Luka versus Jokic. Like, let me get those ones. But yeah, baseball and hockey, it's just immediate, right? It's just immediate, and especially given, you know, the nature of these fan bases now. Anyways, let's take a quick break, and I want to come back and talk a little bit about goodbye to the Arizona Coyotes.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So I got to be brief here. Maybe I'll touch back on this later, but I made a lot of cracks about Arizona Coyotes fans over the years. And I think a lot of you feel the same way, which is, man, who cares about the team that every single season couldn't fill their buildings and constantly had us looking at arena issues and with the NHL relocating, especially as Canadian fans. You look at Arizona with a different... We look down on them. Let's just be honest. We look down on them. We're Canadian hockey fans. We feel like we get the game better, that they don't understand it. And they took a Canadian market away, and that should be in a hockey market. And why not Quebec City over Arizona? Pourquoi? And I got no love for the Arizona Coyotes. Like, whatever. I think the jerseys are pretty cool. The sweaters, the logos is great. I've liked a couple of their players over the course of their history, and they've had some fine runs. They recently have become a bit of a laughingstock. They helped produce Austin Matthews and Matthew Nyes. I appreciate them for that. Shane Doan, I think, is a universally beloved figure in hockey and now part of the Maple Leafs organization. And I don't think there's a soul. I don't think there's a soul in hockey who feels anything for Shane Doan other than, I love that guy. But most of all, like, yeah, you know, you think about them and you go, good, relocate, go to Salt Lake City. We just don't want to hear about this anymore. And yesterday was just a little bit of a reminder for me that, one, I grew up a Seattle Supersonics fan, okay? And I also lived in Victoria when the Grizzlies became a team. And so I've seen two franchises that I cared about relocate. And it sucks. And Seattle's and Vancouver's are far more sympathetic than Arizona's from the way that you can sell it publicly. But sports, the thing I love about it, and I tell people all the time that try to piss on it, that try to be like, you know, oh, it's just a game, or it's just a, why do you care about grown men playing in pajamas and grown men playing a kids game? Why do you care so much about this thing? It's like, yeah, I don't care about this because of the results. I don't idolize the athletes the way that I did as a kid. What you really care about with this stuff is the communities it creates. And not to get too preachy, but, you know, I think we all would agree that we live in a day and age where those are harder to come by than they used to be, that we are a little bit more isolated than we used to be. And losing that part of who you are, that community you have, is devastating. And I feel deeply, like truly, I have nothing to do with the Arizona Coyotes. I feel deeply for those people in Arizona that care about that hockey team. Those people that showed up at city council meetings. Like, I'm trying honestly not to cry thinking about them. Like, genuinely, that's how much I feel bad for these people that showed up to city council meetings in Arizona, going out there in that 100-plus degree weather in a city that's, like, becoming unlivable, where they have people that have to actually go, you know, if we don't have shade in certain places, we just kill people. We got to make sure that we've got enough shade. It's too hot here. Get out of your place and go down to city council and plead for them to figure out a way for you to keep your hockey team. For the players that played there and found themselves there, you know, like guys like Paul Bisignetti, who's obviously the broadcast team. You know how much energy people have to put into this stuff? I know that it looks like, you know, for a lot of people, you know, you just sit down, you watch the game, it's whatever. It's like so many people in broadcasting put everything they have into this. They want to be their best selves. It shows up when somebody's that, you could be unpopular, they could be a homer, whatever. I guarantee you the hours that they're putting into it that you don't see would shock you. That is their community. That's their purpose. And it's crushing. It's crushing to see it. It really is. So, you know, I don't apologize for making jokes about being sick of Arizona. I think we all were sick of Arizona and the stories and the arena. What's the arena update? Who cares? But then when you actually see it and you see the human toll and the community toll, it's tough. And so, yeah, to anybody that's ever cared about a team that doesn't exist anymore, who has lost one of their communities or whatever the hell it is, sport community, yeah, like, I feel for you because it sucks. And yeah, I wish every single person that is involved in it, from someone who lost a job, so someone who lost a career, someone who lost their purpose, someone working within the organization, to the broadcasters, to, you know, whoever it was, the arena workers that worked there, to just fans, the people who cared and who had something that they were looking forward to at 7 o'clock at night. I'm crushed for you. I'm so sorry that this happened. I really am. Quick break, Ben Nicholson Smith. Before I get to Ben Nicholson Smith here, because for the podcast listeners, you don't hear this because we're not allowed to play these songs. I'm putting a temporary ban on all Kendrick Lamar. My boy Mike Jose has played King Kunta. No more Kendrick, because here's the thing. It's time for us. I just talked about community and the need for community. It's time to come together as a country and support Drake. We back Drake on this show, all right? This is a Drake show. And guess what? I actually cared way more about Kendrick's albums. They mean like so much more to me than Drake's. The only Drake album that actually means anything to me really is Views. And fine, you can call me a Drake casual. That's okay. I accept that. I'm just telling you that summer when that came here, 2016, that was a hot summer in Toronto. And it's like the way I remember that year. I'm not a huge Drake guy. I really love some Drake songs. Who doesn't? Drake is like unbelievable, but I would like you know, I've been someone who's looked into OVO stores and gone, who buys that stuff? I've been someone who has cringed at the sight of Drake courtside at Raptors games, joking about the team. I have cringed at Drake wearing Kentucky basketball jumpsuits. I have joked about the Drake. I have taken many, many laughs at Drake's expense. Ha ha ha. It's time to come together as a nation to support Drake. Okay? It's time to come together as a country. The future, true blue Canadians, whatever. Canada, Toronto, you got to be a part of it. We support Drake. There will be no more playing of Kendrick Lamar on this show, on this program, until the beef is resolved. until we get a handshake between these two guys. No more K-Dot. And it breaks me because, again, like, I can genuinely remember where I was when I first listened to Good Kid, Mad City. Like, I can remember exactly where I was when I first listened to that entire album all the way through. And I went, oh my God, I think this is a masterpiece. Like, the excitement that I had to talk to people about it. I never had that for Drake. But I'm sorry. I never had that for Drake. I've never had that for Drake. But we stand with Drake. This is a Drake show. OVO. October's very own. Drake. Drizzy. This is a Drizzy show. All right? Now we've taken our stance. We've picked our side. Ben Nicholson-Smith, my friend and yours. What's up, brother? How are we doing? You stand with Drake before we get going?
Sure.
You,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's no. Oh, my God. No, you got to come out. Buddy, this is wartime. This is wartime. There's no sure. You're in the trenches with all of us.
Put it this way. Like, I'm definitely not a it's probably not something where I'm putting a lot of mental energy one way or the other. But, yeah, for today, I'm totally with you and Drake.
I got to tell you, it's playoff time in sports. It's Blue Jay season. I'm down at the Rogers Center. I'm watching the baseball game. I'm rushing home, watch the Leafs. I'm finishing doing Leafs talk, and I will say that the only thing that I'm giving any mental energy outside of sports right now to is the feud. It's like his hip hop right now. I always have time for great beefs, and that's why, to me, J. Cole, I'm sorry, you're dead to me for the way that you handled this. Like, there's nothing weaker than being like, I didn't feel it in my heart. It's like, hip hop is about competition. The fact that you missed that mark on that is like, you know, you bowed out. I'm sorry. You never should have been in the big three anyways, even though you were one of my favorites. It's over. And RIP J. Cole. I'm sorry that we even covered you in those fake basketball games that we let you play in the city. Okay, so John Schneider strikes again. Apparently Chad Green is hurt, but no, sure. I got to tell you, I was there. You were there. The Rogers Center was pissed, dude. That atmosphere from yesterday that was in there, like, look out, John Schneider. Maybe make some better decisions. So let me start with this. Why are they bringing up Jordan Romano and Eric Swanson when they don't do anything down in AAA and they clearly don't look ready and the bullpen is humming and decide to test them out, both guys, because they could have lost both of these games if not for a miracle play by Lart and Varsho? Why are they testing these guys out in the highest leverage against the most important opponent that they play at home?
It's a tough look, right? And then it's a really tough loss. That's a game they should have won, 100%. You take a lead into the ninth inning, and you have a two-homer game from Varsho. Gausman bounces back. You're on the brink of sweeping. That's a game you've got to win. It's really painful, and I think that it's early in the season, whatever, but still, we all know these losses count, and we all know the Jays aren't going to make the playoffs by three games or miss out by, you know, this huge margin, so these decisions do matter. But I think it's tricky, right? Because when you have Swanson and Romano coming back, it's like, are they ready or not? And once you make the call that they're ready, then they kind of have to be ready to pitch in a game that's relatively big. I mean, you can't assume that it's just going to be this easy entry point. Hey, we're up seven. Perfect. Let's get Swanson ready. So they've made this call. They believe Swanson's ready. And then you're in a situation where you're up by a small margin. You're facing the Yankees. You've got three relievers down, which is a whole other story, but three guys can't go that day. That's a situation to me where I understand why they put Swanson in. It just really didn't work out.
I get it. I mean, they're ready. I guess what I would want to know is, how did they determine that these guys are ready when Jordan Romano specifically is down in Buffalo and he throws one inning and he puts on five base runners with one K? You know, like, what are they seeing here that tells you that you should go from that to being a closer? Like, we're all monitoring the Alek Manoah situation carefully, and granted, like, the situations are very, very, very different in terms of, like, what they put on paper last year, right? But what could possibly tell you that you can't get through a AAA lineup without putting five guys on to, oh, here you go, face the heart of the Yankees order and you'll be fine? Like, how is that made?
And here's the other thing. if you're making that decision with Romano and you're also deciding that he's not ready for back-to-backs, then essentially that means that you have one day that he's ready, one day that he's down. And then that's part of the reason that they were so shorthanded in the bullpen yesterday.
Right.
So the alternative to that would be, you know what, Jordan, you're not quite ready. We want to see you get one more under your belt, and you're going to pitch in Buffalo on Wednesday and join us in San Diego. And meanwhile, Nate Pearson, who obviously was great, throwing 102, probably maybe the only reliever in MLB history to strike out the side and hit 100 and then be optioned. But, you know, that's a whole other story. But, you know, with hindsight being 2020, that's exactly what the Blue Jays should have done, right? Like, the thing is, if we were to dial this back a week ago and say, all right, who do you want? Do you want Mitch White and Nate Pearson, which is who they had? Or do you want 80%? Maybe they're not 100%, but you want 80% of Swanson and Romano. And I think at that point, it would have been a reasonable case to say, we'll take the 80% of Swanson and Romano. It just really didn't work out yesterday on the field.
I got to tell you, neither of those guys looked 80% to me, certainly not Swanson. Right. And that's the other part of this that makes me suspicious is like, why both guys at the exact same time? You know, like, why on the same day, both guys coming up? You're telling me that they're in the exact same trajectory? Like, it's just so strange that Nate Pearson's finally given you something and you decide to rush this decision to get these guys out here in those spots against this team and then put yourself in that situation. And like, you know, even more so, it's like, when did we find out Chad Green was dinged up then? You know what I mean? Like, when did they know this information? Because if they knew that when they made the call up, that makes it even worse.
Yeah, they would have known after Monday.
That's what I'm saying. So the timeline is about an even worse look here.
Yeah, and, you know, because you look at the Chad Green just aspect of all of this, and so that would have been after Monday. He threw 17 pitches. Yep. He would have known at that point that his shoulder didn't feel great. So then going into Tuesday, which is when they activated Romano and Swanson, was before Tuesday's game, they would have had a sense that Green was less than available. And so at that point, I mean, you could IL Green, right? You could. The thing is, at that point, then he's not available to you for 2 weeks, which I don't think that would have been the right call. If he's dealing with a little shoulder soreness, give him 3 days. You don't want him down for 2 weeks. So I understand that part of it. Here's okay, looking back at it with hindsight, I think Swanson, I agree with you, did not look totally ready, and neither did Jordan Romano. So probably the move would be to have those guys get one more rehab outing. Or if you're really convinced that they need to come back and they're completely ready to go, there also would have been a case to option Yenesis Cabrera. And I know he's not a big part of the narrative around this, but Yenesis Cabrera is a lefty reliever. His job is to get out lefty hitters. And what I've seen from him this year is he's allowed a bomb to Yordan Alvarez. He's allowed a bomb to Juan Soto. This is not a guy who's dialed in and getting the results that you want against lefty hitters. So given the choice between him and Nate Pearson, you could also make the case that Cabrera should have been the one who was optioned.
Yeah, I thought that too. My only counter to it was I feel as though it was more of an indictment of them not trusting Meza yet either.
Right, and that's part of it. And, you know, I understand teams like having lefties. Meza obviously has not been at his best, and we saw that again too, right? Meza's the one who allowed the tying hit for Trevino. Meza's the one who allowed the go-ahead hit to Aaron Judge. So despite everything that had happened up to that point, if Meza strikes out Jose Trevino, then you might be on your way to getting out of that inning and you still win the game despite everything that happened. So there's a lot going on here. I think that with the benefit of hindsight, yeah, of course, like those decisions were maybe they rushed those guys back and maybe they should have kept Pearson up. And I think with hindsight, like no doubt that's the way things look. But, you know, at a certain point, you need the players to execute too. And the players did not do that.
No, I agree. I think that the players have to execute, but you as a team have to put them in positions to succeed. And to me, this was like all around failure by everybody involved. Because again, like I do not see, after looking at those two guys, those two outings, I don't see what the hell the case was for them to be out here in those situations. And I get it, like this weird thing they have with Romano of he's our closer. It's like, okay, all right. The guy can't come in a seventh inning once. Right? Like he can't throw one lower leverage spot than closing before putting him in that spot. Okay, Eric Swanson, I get last night it was basically you have to put him there because it was Meza or, you know, Bowden Francis is warming, and I was very confused by it. I was like, nobody in the stadium knew that Chad Green wasn't available until after the game. So I think that, you know, changes a bit of the layer. But, you know, even in the moment, I thought this is very strange that both guys are coming up. This is very strange that it isn't Cabrera instead of Nate Pearson. This is odd that they're rushing these two guys up here, especially when the kid who everybody has been hoping will turn into exactly what he was starting to showcase was starting to finally do it. And then they're like, yeah, yeah, goodbye. Like, get out of here. So, yes, hindsight. But even in the moment, I was like, this doesn't quite compute. And so, yeah, the Jays talked a lot last year after the exit about how they need to have all their transparency of what the plans are and communicate from the front office down a little bit better. And I'm like, this is actually one of those times where it feels like lost in translation as to everything that's going on where you make some of these decisions, because it doesn't make any sense. Benny, especially since there was an off day coming up. Like, there's an off day.
Yeah, it's really tough to have three relievers down the day before an off day. It really is. And partly, like, what we're seeing here is, okay, so you would want, I think that if you're watching this team, you probably want the Blue Jays to operate with a sense of urgency this season.
Bingo.
You don't want them waiting too long, right? So you don't want them sitting back on their heels. And I think what we're seeing here is almost the downside of that sense of urgency, where, okay, Kevin Gausman barely pitches all spring. Let's toss him in to the very last game. Okay, he's good to go, right?
Yep.
They declare Kevin Gausman good to go. And yesterday, actually, we saw the benefit of that with Kevin Gausman, because, you know, he could still be rehabbing at AAA. Like, if they had actually given him a proper ramp up, he'd be at AAA right now. He wouldn't even be in the major leagues, but they rushed him back. He was up for it. And now he's contributing and he's getting back to being himself and shutting the Yankees down for five innings. Now, we can also say they probably rushed Swanson and Romano back before they were fully, fully ready. They hadn't really succeeded at AAA, but those guys wanted to help and the Jays wanted the help. And that's where you see the downside of them operating with that sense of urgency.
Totally. Completely agree. Anyway, you could feel it in the building yesterday quite palpably. it's incredible that they just won three series in a row, that they had a largely successful homestand, you know, what, 6-3, I think? Yeah, right?
Yep.
Yeah, 6-3, but yeah, God, 7-2 sure sounds great in terms of the way that you're rolling that out. But yeah, you go 6-3 and you beat the Yankees, and yeah, it's an ugly way to lose for sure, but yet it still just feels that way. That's the thing that really pisses me off is, you had a moment to just shut everybody up and go, man, look how good Varsho's looking. You know, look how good the pitching is. Wow. Gausman, the last piece of the rotation to figure things out, he goes out and figures it out, right? There's just all these reasons for optimism. And then they just kicked it. Like, they kicked it right out the door on their way for an off day where this is going to kind of sit with them in an ugly fashion until they go play San Diego, but whatever. So your read on Gausman is everything is now fine, right? We just needed that one outing and now we got it and we're good. Cause yeah, there was no pitch count. There was nothing. It was early in the game where he did look a little shaky. He's walking guys in the first inning, and I went, oh, my God, no, no, no. But he settled in, and now we're all feeling that this is now fine. The story can be put to bed.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look back to the end of spring training, like his – I don't have it in front of me, but his final start of spring would have been like March 23rd, something like that. And so, you know, here we are, you know, 3.5 weeks removed from that. That's a pretty quick ramp up still. You know, like pitchers in the course of a normal spring would get 4.5 weeks to ramp up fully to opening day. So I think now we're getting to the point that Kevin Gausman is like basically his normal self. We're seeing the velocity, who's up this time compared to his previous start against the Rockies, where he really struggled. And then the stuff was good too. He was back to throwing the splitter a lot, got a lot of good swing and miss there, mixed in the slider. So you're seeing the stuff, you're seeing the velo, you're seeing you know, hearing him, talking to him after the game, he said he felt it was a step in the right direction. So at this point, you know, this is not a bad place to be with Kevin Gausman. He has the 8.16 ERA. So obviously that looks ugly. But from this point on, I think there's a lot of reason to believe that he can be a frontline starter for this team.
Yeah. Okay. Next thing. Thing of positivity from this week. Dalton Varsho ripped some lefties. Lefties came in and he went, that's fine. I'm still going to look confident at the plate. Looks confident out in the field, right? Like, I stood right behind him for yesterday's game, watching him play. Obviously, he's great at that. He made two incredible plays. And yes, the defense is outrageously good. And there's no question there. It's just, you know, if you're only defense, what is that for you? But all of a sudden, that's the way the ballpark was supposed to play, right? On that second home run is, oh, that's it. That's what they thought they were trading for. I'm not going to freak out about it because he has been a bit of a streaky guy. But, yeah, do you think that we're seeing a little bit different from Dalton Varsho here? Are we starting to see the beginnings of normalization for him?
Yeah, I think that even if you look at his career, last year was really a down year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for him to be out there homering off lefties, I'm not holding my breath on that to happen a whole lot. But
sure.
For him to actually show some power and tap into that on a more consistent basis – I mean, yeah, this is a guy who hit 27 homers a couple of years ago. I see no reason that he can't go out there and hit 25 to 30 again. He's in his prime. He's healthy. I mean, we all know about the defense, but I think we're seeing more conviction from him at the plate, maybe ambushing some first pitch fastballs that hang out over the plate, like we saw yesterday from Ferguson. So this is a great step for the Jays. They need all the offense they can get, right? Because we are not seeing a lot of home runs from this team. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a team offensively that, you know, Cavan Biggio has been their second best offensive player, right? That's not where you want to be after, you know, it's not a tiny sample anymore.
No.
It's 3 weeks. I mean, it's a small sample, but it's not nothing. And Cavan Biggio has been your second best hitter. So, you know, they need everything they can get. And if Varsho can run into one here and there, that's great. And I think that's totally possible. Everything I saw from him in spring, he looked locked in. He's looked really good offensively and defensively. To me, this is a really good major league player in his prime.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I really hope so. It was kind of it's funny looking at, you know, we're still in the phase where a 2-home run game changes your OPS from, I think Varsho entered 6-something yesterday and then finishes 7.67. It's just the numbers popped immensely from just these last couple of performances. So yeah, you can look at this next question through that lens, but. I'm optimistic about him. I'm fine with Bo Bichette because we've seen it before, right? Like, we've seen the slow starts before. Vladdy actually looks all right. At least he's hitting singles more frequently. Like, he's looking all right. He still has his horrific at-bats where you're like, holy crap. Yeah. And he had a couple of them again yesterday. But my number one point of concern has become very clear. And I think by leaving the name out and doing that little rant, you can probably guess where I'm going with this. I guess, how concerned are you about this player? Do you know who I'm referencing?
Could be a couple guys. Kevin Kiermaier?
No. Kiermaier, I never liked from the start because it was just, you know, you got your good year. You're supposed
Springer.
To kind of. Yeah, it's Springer, man.
Yeah.
219 so far. And, like, yeah, it's getting late early for him, in my opinion.
Okay, so it's interesting with Springer, right? Because, like, talking to the players after the games this week, I mean, they're really impressed with the caliber of at-bats that George Springer has had, okay? So, you know, just putting that out there, that the players really appreciate that he's grinding out there and fouling off a lot of pitches, and they're noticing that. So, fine. That's great. But, all right, let's look at the results. He's got a 666 OPS, and he has 2 home runs. So, you know, that's pretty middling. That's basically the definition of league average. 98 OPS plus, below league average. And you look at Springer's offensive performance, he has consistently hit for less and less power. If you look at his isolated power, he's also striking out less, but the trade-off doesn't really work. Like, the overall offensive production is trending in the wrong direction, and he is no longer a dominant or dynamic offensive threat. He's just not at this point. He's a guy who can put the bat on the ball and hit a single and steal a base. He's almost become that more traditional leadoff hitter, as opposed to being that, okay, he's batting leadoff, but he's going to run into 35 home runs, and essentially he's a number 3 hitter who's hitting leadoff.
Mm-hmm. I'm concerned.
It's 3 more years.
Well,
right. So I think it makes sense to have some level of concern.
But it's 3 more years, but it's also what I think he means to this team this season for some of the reasons that Yell Line is like, they don't hit a lot of home runs. And if you were looking at, I never really buy into the spring training narratives, right? It's the only one that I did get a little too wrapped up in this year that I regret was Bowden Francis, where I'm like, oh, wow, like this is some intriguing stuff here. And then it turns out it's like, nope, he's 4A, right? He's fine. He's all right. He's not going to surprise people. I'm like, is this guy going to be a 4-star today? Is he going to give you... take some of the pressure off of a Kikuchi contract, he says. Like, what's this look like? No, it's fine. But the one thing was, there were two guys that from spring anyways, people had been sort of buzzing about and going, hey, Varsho's confidence is back and he's feeling different with the refresh season, blah, 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 blah. And then the other was Springer, is look at the spring numbers and look how he's feeling, and he feels a little bit more back. And so some guys, I think starts were a little bit more important, and I would put him into that category.
Yeah, and if you look at, okay, his isolated power, his first year in Toronto, 291,
yeah.
Then 205, then 147, then 110. So, you know, yeah, like we're seeing a drop-off, right? And yeah, like, you know, not to say that he's probably got a little more in the tank than that this year, but this was a guy when they signed him to the biggest contract in franchise history worth $150 million that you thought, okay, this guy's got 30 homer potential, right? Like he's certainly, you know, I mean, that's putting it lightly, maybe 35 homer potential. And it just hasn't been there. He has not been that power bat. And I'm not saying that there's a better alternative right now at leadoff. You know, I think that the way this offense is going, it's fine to have him as your leadoff hitter. It's just, he has not reached the offensive ceiling that you would hope that he would get to. And I don't think anyone with the Jays is ever going to say that, because you know, they like some things that he brings, and no one wants to insult George Springer. But The reality is you were probably hoping for more offensively.
Yeah, it's just funny because the one thing you thought was that you would maintain at least most of the offensive production, that there would be a dip. But hey, can you keep him healthy? Can you keep him healthy? And now he's been healthy, and yet the decline has happened in a meaningful way, right? Remember a couple of seasons ago when it was, look at what their cumulative win-loss record is with him in the lineup versus without? And how it was, holy crap, this guy genuinely might be the MVP. They need to keep him healthy. And now he has been, and it's not working out. And yeah, I certainly know the way that I feel when he's coming to the dish in a big spot, and that's not confident whatsoever. Why is Manoah with the team? Like, what is happening here? Why is he in the dugout?
Yeah, so it's because he's working out of Buffalo. And,
yeah.
You know, so there's always a fair amount of, you know, movement between those two cities when you have AAA so close. And So he's essentially wanting to be around the team. He wants to work out around the team.
So this is him.
Blue Jays. Oh, yeah. He wants to be here for sure.
Huh.
If he didn't want to be here, he wouldn't be here. He definitely wants to be around the team.
Huh. It's just kind of odd to see him in the dugout rooting guys on. And then it's like, hey, man, guess drive to Buffalo tomorrow. Right? It's just... It's very strange to me. It's like, man, go to Buffalo, make it work in Buffalo. Stop thinking about here. No offense, I love Manoah, but go to Buffalo. Stay in Buffalo.
He does the walk in. I mean, if you were watching the game from left field yesterday, you would have seen all the starting pitchers kind of do that walk in from the bullpen, right?
Mm-hmm.
With the starter, and Manoah is a part of that every day. As is Bowden Francis, which is, you know, interesting because he's essentially not in the rotation. But
whatever, you can give him a little grace period for him. You know, it's been tough going.
Yeah.
He lived his major league dream, and it was just like bang, 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 bang. It's like he can get let him sit around with Kikuchi and drink the $3,000 whiskey and do the walk for a little while longer.
Sure. Yeah. Look, I have no problem with that whatsoever. But it's just interesting, right? It gives you an insight into like how the team is kind of working. And in the case of Manoah, yeah, like, you know, he's got a big start coming up tomorrow in, I think it's in Rochester, but with the Buffalo team, to really see if he can build on what he did. I mean, he threw a lot of strikes last time in AAA, but
yeah,
he allowed a lot of hits.
I was going to say, where'd they go? To the catcher's mitt or into the field?
Yeah. You want to see Manoah getting some results. Now, I think it's that point that he's showing he can be in the strike zone a little bit more. So now you want to see some results, but there's opportunity in the majors. I think he has to show more to earn that for sure. I don't think he's earned it yet, but it's interesting to watch every time he takes the mound.
Yeah. I was listening to Kevin Barker and Jeff Blair the other day, and they had a great segment on it. And Barks was basically saying it's time, right? Like we're over the process and whatever. And for Blair, he said these things will figure themselves out if he's good. But I can't help but think like tomorrow it's Yariel, right? It's Rodriguez on the bump. You know, this guy came out and really impressed, and it's one start and it's basically nothing, right? It's basically nothing at this point. Like we've had Jesse Litch go out and have the most memorable debut, right? Let's see what it actually ends up being. But yeah, if he's good, it's going to get, like, you really want him around doing this thing if he's not getting better at Buffalo? Like, at some point, you got to draw the line. I don't know. It just feels weird, man.
Yeah.
It just feels a little odd to me. It's like this isn't the normal thing. And it would be one thing if it was last season, right, where he's working out his struggles or even that he had some success, whatever. It's just, I just want the guy to be focusing on getting better at pitching and not being here with the Blue Jays. And I'm sure he would argue that here is best for him. And I don't know it ins the ins and out of it, but yeah, just, you know, I kind of want him doing the Shohei thing, not the gambling, the go to your hotel and study and then go and do baseball and then, take care of business, bro.
Yeah, I get that. I think every pitcher is different, and Manoah clearly, you know, seems to enjoy it. He seems to get some benefit from talking pitching with these guys. Mm-hmm. Certainly the training facilities are better in Toronto. I get that as well. But hey, to your point, I mean, there is an expiration date on this, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Literally there is, because I think it was, I don't have it in front of me, but let's say it was April the 9th that he made his first rehab start in the minor leagues. So that starts his clock. So that's 30 days. So after that point, and Manoah obviously is not going to be with the Jays on this upcoming road trip. It's not like he's going to fly to San Diego.
Traveling, yeah.
Yeah. But at that point, the Jays will have to make a call. They'll have to say, is Manoah a major league pitcher right now? And again, I would tend to say that answer will reveal itself, right? You don't have to rush to an answer. If you rush him into the major leagues right now, I don't think you'd be happy with the results.
No.
I don't think he is showing that he is a major league pitcher right now. And I would err on the side of caution as long as I had a viable alternative if I was the Jays. But there will come a point that they have to say, is he a major leaguer or do we option him? Which is an option. You can do that. You can just say, you know what? Your window expired and we are now going to send you to AAA. And at that point, he would not be permitted to be around the major league team.
Okay. So, and this is sort of what I'm driving at with all of it and why I have some level of concern, because him being there around the team is mostly fine, whatever. And maybe it is the preparation that's debatable, whatever, you know, my way of wanting it versus his way of feeling it. It's like, you know, clear which side of that is more important. The thing that I think is sort of impossible to ignore in seeing him here is that there is that clock, there is that timeline, and when it expires, what is the reaction going to be if the Jays don't conclude he's ready for the majors? My guess, and I feel as though it's at least an educated guess, even though it is clearly a guess, is he will be very nonplussed based on what we have historically with him and based on what we're seeing where he wants to be here around the team right now. Yeah, I don't think that he's going to take that news very well, even if things aren't going well for him process-wise.
Yeah, and I think that's a possibility. I don't disagree with your read. Clearly this is a player who, like every player, prefers to be in the major leagues, making a major league salary as opposed to riding buses in Rochester.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't fault him for that. I'm just saying, like, some guys would, have to go down there and be like, God, I've got to be humble. I got to figure this out and I need more time down here. I don't think that's where he's at mentally.
Yeah. And so, you know, we'll see what that looks like. And this is where the Jays still have another, I want to say it's at least two more weeks to determine what that looks like. And he can make more starts. And, you know, I don't see a problem with letting this play out. I think that if you're talking about this team, it's not even super high on my list of questions or concerns with this team because, you know, to go
me
back
neither.
To some of the stuff you mentioned before, like maybe it is, you know, Springer's power or Vladdy still chasing sliders off the edge of the plate.
Like by 4 feet that start off the plate.
Right. Yeah. And it's maybe it's really unfair. I know, you know, we just watched Juan Soto come into town and Juan Soto is a Hall of Famer. Juan Soto is like just so good. One of the best plate approaches really of all time. Certainly since Barry Bonds, like Soto is maybe the best plate approach since Barry Bonds. But at the same time, Vladdy was supposed to be an elite player too. And Soto's plate approach, especially on pitches low in the zone, is just so good. He's just got such a good eye for pitches and he will take his walks. He will happily walk 120 times and he knows that's going to get him paid. That's part of the reason that he might make $500 million in free agency. And I just think, you know, when you look at the numbers and the pitch charts on Vladdy, it's clear what right-handed pitchers should do to him. And it's just throw those sliders off the plate when you get to two strikes.
Yeah, he gets his single to start the game yesterday. You go, nice. And then from that point forward, it was basically slider, 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 off the plate, slider. And he waved over a billion of them. There was one at-bat yesterday that was genuinely another It was awful. It still feels like a lot of guessing, and that there is a book and that there is a hole and you didn't expect them to have it. I don't think it is unfair because, yeah, these two players were compared. And in fact, you know, I said I would have 100% traded the 2 years of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for the 1 year of Juan Soto. And I'm feeling more and more confident in that opinion after what we saw in this last series, even though Vladdy has been fine.
Yeah, right. He's been fine. But yeah, Soto has been on a different level.
No, different guy.
This is really a player that, I don't think the Jays were ever super close to acquiring him, but man, is he ever a difference maker? And and Vladdy just hasn't been that. He has not done that same amount of damage to pitches that are hanging, and he hasn't put himself in those advantage counts consistently enough.
No, you know what this is too, is what it really boils down to is just a dumb guy analysis, which is, when the Yankees have guys up in big spots like yesterday where Soto's coming up and Judge is coming up, you feel terrified as a fan, right? You're just like, oh my God, no, 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 no. And it feels inevitable almost. Even, again, if that's confirmation bias. But the Blue Jays, they got a lot of guys who are fine. You know, it's okay. But there's nobody that strikes fear in you. Like, you think there's any single Blue Jay that steps to the dish and the other team, if they're paying remote attention, is like, no, 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 not him, not now, not here. That's not a thing. Like, who is that? Bo?
I think there's an aspect of that with Vladdy and with Bo.
Because
Vladdy can do damn. I mean, he can make a pitcher look bad.
Not saying he can't. I just don't think that. I don't think there's a Blue Jays fan on earth that when he steps up in a big spot right now, they're like, oh, you've done it now. You know, you walk a guy in front of him in a big spot. Like, had the roles been reversed yesterday, right? Like, if it's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at the plate, and they're coming back against the New York Yankees, and they've got the opposing stadium shaking. I don't think there's a single Blue Jays fan watching on TV that's like, you screwed up. You screwed up, Yankees. You gave Vladdy a chance to get to the plate. Like, who thinks that now? You know, like, nobody. Nobody thinks that way.
Well, and the lineup just isn't deep enough to this point in the season where, you know, they can just do damage up and down the lineup, because sometimes you're looking at a bottom of the order and it's maybe Clement and Kiermaier and IKF, you know, and it's just that part of the order isn't going to strike fear into people, especially, you know, with Kiermaier off to the start that he is, and maybe he's the guy who needs to take some breathers. You know, I'm all for getting Dalton Varsho into the lineup regularly when he's hitting this well. Clement, Davis Schneider, there are going to be times that you want to get those guys in, so that makes sense to me. But yeah, this is not a lineup 1-9 that's as dominant as it has been at various points in recent Blue Jays history.
Benny, thanks as always for the time, and thanks for putting up with my angry texts.
Of course. Anytime, JD.
Cheers, buddy. Ben Nicholson-Smith, senior MLB editor here at Sportsnet, and of course at The Letters, and guy that works on the broadcast as well. Anyway, yeah. He's right. There's other things to be worried about. It's just, it was hard for me not to notice the Manoah stuff. Like, he's quite a imposing figure down there. Like, he's kind of hard to miss. But yeah, ultimately, that one, it's just like the Matthews thing. It's like, you did a good job. You did a good job. You were right there. You won 6, lost 3, and you won all the home series. It's just like, but you could have gone 7-2. And it's just like, you could have 7-0. Yeah, it feels a little incomplete today from both sides. From both of those teams. Anyways, also felt incomplete from the other team. That's next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
This is a Drake show. Yeah. Drop him, give him 50. I'm shocked to say this. Masai Ujiri had his exit interview yesterday, and I don't care to play any part of it. The most quotable, most social-friendly clip from Masai Ujiri was him saying he's still bleeping. He broke out the cuss words. He broke out the cussing for you and I and Raptors faithful. He cussed, went back to the original playbook, the day one playbook, throw out a swear. You're still Masai Ujiri. All right. So nobody's going to tell you what to do. Got it. You answer to yourself. You answer to the few people that are in your direct circle, and that's it, and yourself. Okay. You know what was the basic summation of this entire thing? It can save you watching or listening or reading threads or whatever. It's that for the first time in Masai Ujiri's tenure, or at least for the first time, even actually when at the beginning, when Weena North, when they stumbled into that, when the Knicks foolishly declined the Lowry trade, the vision at that point was to strip it down and go after Andrew Wiggins. And then quickly it pivoted. And the visions were clear from that, basically the entire tenure of Masai Ujiri. I said it with Will Liu last week. Or actually, that was this week, right? That was this week. God, it's a long week. Time is long. I got long days right now, brother. I got some long days. Earlier this week, Monday's program, which you can listen to on Spotify and on iTunes and on, you can see it on YouTube. You can subscribe to this podcast. You can leave 5 stars and you can really help me out. You can leave a review on the iTunes page specifically. That would be great. Subscribing to those things. Wow, what a nice thing you could do today. But if you were a subscriber, if you did go back and you did listen to that interview, you would know that where I was kind of searching with Will, it's a lot of times, even with James, it's like, I'll have smart people on and I'll try to search for what the thought is. And that was the thought is, I don't know what the plan is anymore. Like, I don't even, it's supposed to look like a rebuild, but I'm not really sure it's a rebuild. It's like they're about to pay quickly a ton of money, you know? Barnes is up for a ton of money soon. It's a lot of guys who, you know, they got Poeltl. He's making a ton of money. They just paid Kelly Olynyk. It's a lot of guys who are about to be paid for a full rebuild. Okay. Okay, so you're not going to sign free agents. We get that because you're Toronto. You got to hit on these draft picks. And he said that this draft, they got to find all-stars and every draft has all-stars and blah, 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 blah. But again, we already know that how Masai feels about this draft because of the way he acted the year prior, which was correct, actually. Again, if you really want to feel anything positive about what Masai Ujiri has done over the last few years, it's like, yeah, you know what? He did realize that this draft that we're about to head into is pretty garbage. So he stands at the podium, and normally he speaks with just a tremendous amount of conviction, and you really do feel as though, man, this is a guy with a plan. And yesterday it was basically, well, we'll see. It was a lot of that. It was basically him saying for his entire time, we'll see how it goes. Okay. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes with Scotty. We'll see how it goes with Quickly. We'll see how it goes with RJ. We'll see how it goes with Grady. We'll see how it goes with the draft. We'll see. We'll see how it goes if an opportunity comes up. We'll see how it goes in free agency. There you go. That's the Coles notes of Masai Ujiri yesterday. I'm guessing a lot of guys wrote big fancy articles that didn't, you know, that used a lot of words. I could have saved them some time too. We'll see. That's the Masai Ujiri credo right now. Okay. That's like what my credo would be. We'll see. All right. Not exactly the most inspiring exit. And you can say that these things don't mean anything, except for with Masai Ujiri, they really have. Year over year, go back, listen to the exit interviews, the urgency in which he spoke with, the conviction in which he spoke with, and the last couple of years, it's changed. It's been notable, noticeable. And this is someone who, too, by the way, has pretty much been on record with the way that he's developed teams is no rebuilds. And so, yeah, what is the stomach, what is the patience going to be for all of this when we haven't exactly seen that throughout his tenure? The other thing that I got to ask Grange about is like how the money works with him in terms of his contract and the values of these franchises. Also, I got to say, too, I thought two things. If I really want to be critical, I thought there were two things that Masai Ujiri made mistakes on yesterday. One is, like, why are you calling Jonte Porter the kid? And, why are you human? This guy, Jonte Porter, you know, yesterday gets a lifetime ban from the NBA. And it's found out that he bet against your team, dude. He bet against you. And it's like, sad to see for the kid, and we did everything in our hands. It's like, maybe be a little bit more stern in your assessment of Jonte Porter. I think you can kind of call his character into question at this point. I think it's kind of fair that this guy who placed an $80,000 bet on an under prop for him isn't free from criticism. So yeah, I kind of wish Masai Ujiri would have taken a harder stance on that. And then the other one was, and I know this is a tougher one, tougher line to kind of thread and tougher needle to thread, but you know, Raptors fans, prices are going up 20%. That's a big jump. And everybody's feeling it in their pocketbook right now. Everybody's feeling the pinch, okay? It's like, It's pretty stressful times in Canada right now. It's around the world, yeah, sure. Inflation in a lot of places, you know. But Canadians in this city feeling the pinch, and I thought it was pretty unempathetic the way that that was handled. The discussion around the fans that are going to be priced out of these stadiums, because I do feel for that. I know what it meant to me to go to a basketball game with my dad. I know what that meant to me. And I want that to be an experience that everybody can have, always. And so, yeah, to kind of poo-poo it and be like, oh, well, that he said, what was the line? He's like, but that's just business. I went, oh, okay. Cool. That's cool. I guess so, if you say so. Just, this is a guy with power. This is a guy with real weight. He could have said something, you know? He could have, his voice matters a little bit more than the rest of us, the commoners, as you will. So, yeah, was pretty disappointed in that. But anyways, same old for them as of right now. And it's like, yeah, you know what? The draft is going to be somewhat interesting. Hopefully it reinvigorates a little bit of this team just in terms of having a couple of, you know, three bodies potentially in here, three young guys that even if the class isn't very strong that you can kind of put some hope in. That's great. But ultimately, Raps look like they're heading into the wilderness for a while. And I'm not sure exactly where they're going to stack or what the level of interest is going to be and, yeah, how this is going to play out. For the first time in a while, I got no clue what's going to go on with the Toronto Raptors. It's going to feel like a bit of a grind, I think. Yeah, and the Jonte Porter thing, it's like...
You think the Raps need to add extra parameters to their vetting process in the future? Because this was their team. At the end of the day, it happened on their team on a guy... That was on their
team. Oh, that? Yeah, I don't know. That's not on the Raps. You can't be vetting all your players. Like, that's on the league. And the system worked, to be honest. Like, it worked. They caught the guy who was betting on himself. I just think it's actually so funny that they thought they were going to get away with an $80,000 Jonte Porter under bet. It's just, like, because they said, okay, so I read the report, and it was like $15 to $22,000 were the bets that he placed himself on other people's accounts. He generated a payout of $76,000, net winnings of $21,000, basically 22. It's like, cool, man, you got banned from the NBA for 22 G's?
There's guys at Casino Rama making more than that at a poker table.
Yeah,
right,
like,
now.
Buddy, what are you doing? 22 G's, that's what it was for your name to be. And you know what sucks is, I don't know, like, if I was Michael Porter, I wouldn't want the text between me and my brother. It was like, hey, guess what? I know my brother's a DJ. I'll just say that.
NBA
hey, guess what? My brother's a DJ. I'm aware of it. I know the depths of his. I talked out of bets the other day with UFC. He was talking about some pretty heavy units, and I went, why are we doing this? Like, anyway, I would know. Anyway, so.
MPJ investigation.
No.
He's out the first round.
I just think here's what I would say about MPJ is like, yeah, it's you casted those doubts on your brother, which sucks. And I would hate that if it was me. And I hurt my brother's name, and he was successful. And I know he would feel the same way about me. That's kind of a tragedy for a guy that's an NBA champion. And so, yeah, Jonte Porter, loser. Like, flat out, what are you supposed to say about this? 22 grand to disparage your family name and your legacy? You know how hard it is to make the NBA? That guy did it, and then it was all for this? Moron. So if Masai won't say it, I will. Anyways, subscribe to the podcast, follow on Twitter and Instagram, @JDBunkus. I'll see you tomorrow.